Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjees. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they're also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Misha Adishmukai. I'm an entrepreneur here in Adishmukai. I'm running on one side a financial services company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Banerjees.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone. And for our viewers from Far East, good night.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjees. Today we are at week 10 of season 2. And we are here because the world is changing. In our show, we interview investors, policymakers, business leaders, impactful businesses in order to create impact, to encourage them to create more impact if they're already doing it, or to inspire you, our dear audience, to take in action and change your life and life of many other people for better.
So before we start, as many of you know that my sister Joya passed away more than a month ago, and we still are doing a project called Project Joya. You can find all information on chamomile.ch. That is chamomile.ch. And we are trying to get help and support to people in the rural areas of India, people who cannot afford or who are underprivileged people. So please, all your help is welcome. And many, many of our viewers and people have already helped. So thank you very, very much to them.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot. And usually we talk about our course, but at the moment we are not running any courses. So
we are completely
the summer
full.
Is coming completely overbooked with mentorship students. But anyway, keep an eye on Chamomile. One day or sooner or later, we will announce the next course on profitable business with impact, where you can learn about how do you actually create a business which is not only profitable, but most importantly, also impactful and does something good for our planet and for people. Do you have any story today? But something cool, something big.
Okay, so normally, as you all know, environment and climate is my favorite. So that's why I have been talking quite a lot about climate justice. But today I want to talk about social justice. So we have been hearing since a long, long time that companies like Facebook, Google, Amazon, Starbucks, they have been hardly paying any taxes at all, especially in the markets and in the countries where they are making their most profits. Although now President Biden is trying to catch up to it. He's trying to fix the global tax system, and he's even backed by the G7. Although, of course, the Republicans are trying to sink it for obvious reason.
But isn't it old news? I mean, it's nothing new to mention here, there. Rich people usually don't pay taxes or very little.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly my point for today. That what we know that the world is reeling still with the COVID-induced economic downturn. Hundreds of millions, even in India and other countries in the United States, people are being pushed into poverty, bankruptcies, unemployment rising everywhere. And people are really, really having trouble to make their ends meet. But there's a magazine called ProPublica in the United States, which is an investigative journalistic magazine. And they got access to super, super secret IRS data from the United States and came with following points. Jeff Bezos, the world's richest man, paid 0 cent tax in the year 2007 and 11. Mm-hmm. Apparently, in fact, he and his ex-wife had been receiving child benefits from the government.
Well, they have the right for that, no?
Exactly.
Why not?
And the list goes on. Same is valid for Elon Musk, who is now a role model for many, especially the youth. Even my son is crazy about him. It turns out he pays no federal income tax. And the list goes on. Michael Bloomberg, Carl Icahn, George Soros. Wow. So while median American household earns $70,000 annually and pays 14% federal tax, and the highest income tax rate is around 37%, this completely debunks the Republican theory that all pay their fair share and the rich ones carry the most burden.
Wow, this is really like cool scandal, no? And like, I want to thank the person who leaked out the data for his or her bravery, because I guess this person, when he or she was doing the taxes, she just had it. Maybe he was or she was paying more than those people. And it's kind of not about justice right here. And the thing is, actually, those people are using the same children's school or market to sell their products, labor infrastructure, for which we are paying.
Exactly.
And they are not paying even a cent for that. So in other words, they are living on the money of others, which I think Tesla inventor could afford to do something more than that.
Yeah, that's my point. So that's, and this is not only limited to US, it's also happening in Europe, and I'm sure it's happening in other countries in the world. So that is my point, is where is the social justice?
Well, thank you for this depressing but hot news, Ben, today. And the question is actually, what do we do with that? And do they themselves realize that it's not the right thing what they're doing? Like, is Elon Musk, who is also representing sustainability with electric car, realizing what he is doing and which message he is sending out there for millions of people and youth? And this is why we are not talking only about impact investing, but for me, it's much more, it's consciousness shift, that we are here not just trying to create profit by using impact, but is actually impact first, you know, the mission should be first, and then along the way we can live with that, so we can sustain our livelihoods and our lives. So this is what I think about it.
Thank you. And today I want to, since every time I tell the story, so today I want, before we get our guests in, Svetlana, please explain to the audience, because I hear everywhere sustainable investment, sustainable products, financial products, but I hardly hear about impact investment. Just in short, can you explain to our viewers what is in basic difference in a layman's language, the difference between impact investment and sustainable investment?
Well, impact investing is also belongs to sustainable investing, but not vice versa. So basically, if you look at the market, the sustainable investment market globally is around $31 trillion. Impact investing is only part of it, $800 billion. And the big difference is that the most sustainable investment practices, they start with simple exclusion of certain industries like tobacco, gambling industry, or weapon pornography. And then they go further towards impact. They define ESG, environmental social governance practices, to select better enterprises based on these criteria, which they reduce waste, or they empower women, so more women are at the top positions, and so on, right? And they are slowly, step by step, going into impact investing, which is at the top of that pyramid, and which needs much more capital, because impact investing has an underlying mission compared to sustainable investment, which are still mostly profit-driven compared to impact. So here is a big difference, and like iceberg, if you look at that, so sustainable investment is broad impact. We need them. We need big corporations, of course, to transform and change industry standards. But we desperately need more capital into impact investing, which are trying to solve also sustainable development goals defined by United Nations.
Okay. Now, at least I understood what it means. So now we want to invite our guest for today. Welcome, Mika.
Welcome, 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 Mikko Antonen.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. It was interesting to hear those tax news from United States. Here in Nordics, we all pay taxes, and it can be also checked by everyone from the authorities. So our system, at least, is very transparent and very different compared to any other areas of the planet. So in that respect, we can be at least proud of that.
Exactly.
And this is why you can be so cozy in your chair, right? Because the consciousness is fine, then everything is
fine. And the best is, in America, instead of finding out why this is going wrong, they have started an investigation to find out who leaked out the tax report.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good question. That's why they are doing something like that. I guess it's a big part of the history, and taxes at the beginning of the mankind, where the taxes were invented. Most of the cases, taxes were collected by kings or somebody like that, and they didn't deliver too much back to the people who paid taxes, and that's why the culture to pay taxes is in most of the areas of the planet quite low. But in Finland, for example, we have always got quite a lot back while we have paid taxes, and the whole social security system, education system, they are all free. So if you compare that what we are paying taxes, you are getting benefit back straight away, and everybody is getting that. And I guess that is the one reason why Finns and Nordic societies overall, they are happy taxpayers, because they are getting quite high benefits back. Education in United States, for example, it will cost a lot of money, and we will get it all for free.
Yeah. I didn't want to get into this discussion, but I had a very interesting chat today with my son during breakfast, because he's studying history, and he was talking about Versailles. That in Versailles, the king used to get all the taxes, where he spent more money on his food than maybe the whole city could live on. And that's how it collapsed.
If we will look at the history and look at all those places where we are visiting and watching, wow, what a kind of building here, who has made it, and how is it possible? And we should remember that somebody has collected taxes, build up the monument for himself or somebody else, for the queen or lover or whatever. And now we are visiting places and say, oh, fantastic.
So this is why I suggest, let's go to the present and please introduce Mika to our audience.
So, with this, I introduce Mika. He's not only my colleague at Climate Leadership Coalition, but he is the founder, principal shareholder, and chairman of the energy company called ST1. It's a Nordic company. He began his career as a private individual in fuel trade in 96 and built it up to this diverse Nordic energy company, which today pursues its vision to become a leading producer and seller of CO2 aware energy. So this is like music to our ears. So this company's Mika's company is investing very, very heavily into renewable energy research and production, from industrial wind power to advanced biocells, and of course geothermal, because I myself have visited your factory at Espoo. So with this, we welcome Mika.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, so as Ben mentioned, and before we start, I'd like you to tell also your story, what people don't know about you or what we didn't say, to make it more interesting,
introduction, but how did
what
you
is
end
your
up,
story?
How did you come in the petroleum sector or in the fossil fuel sector?
I'm not very good to talk about myself, so I try to keep it short, but... it was a coincidence. Basically, I was studying in University of Technology in Helsinki, energy, and one morning I got a call, and it came from the trading department of Neste Oil. Neste Oil is a local oil company nowadays, the biggest renewable diesel producer worldwide, and they have noticed that I have done something crazy things in my university studies or same time, and they like the activity what I have done, and they ask, could you come to interview and join us to work? We need persons like you for international trading. And I said, well, why not? And then I ended up to the Neste trading department. At that time, trading business globally, it was a very new thing. We lived at the year 1989, and there were not too many people who were doing the trading overall, and it was very huge opportunity for young student like myself, and I took advantage out of it, and I worked very hard at these first 5-6 years. At that time, we didn't have any mobile phones or things like that, so you had to be in the office all the time. And when Singapore started very early in the morning, 4 a.m. And then the New York finished 10 o'clock late evening. It was lucky that my wife at that time, she was working also elsewhere, so we didn't have too much home problems during that period. But really, I learned a lot. I was capable to do the business around the world, and it was a fantastic opportunity. And then I started to see how this world really looked like from energy system perspective, and it was a very good school to learn the global energy system. And in certain point, 96, I decided that well, I have got all the lessons from this company, but unfortunately, I cannot see that future is in corporate. I would like to be entrepreneur, and I started to do same things for my own account. And I was very lucky, I have to say. I was young. I couldn't understand all the risk. if I would have understood them, probably I wouldn't have started. And we didn't have at that point, we didn't have children. That was big thing as well, that I didn't have responsibility to take care of the family. My wife is much more well educated than I am. She's a doctor and cancer doctor, and doing much more valuable work than I am. But anyway, I had an opportunity, and I was very lucky at the beginning. Oil price was very low, and I was capable to do the business between the continents, and that was really my core competence. And when the children start to come to the picture, it was a year 2000 something. Then I started to think that what is the purpose of my life? That it cannot be that I'm buying cargo from South or Europe and selling that to the South America, or buying cargo from Europe and selling that to United States. There has to be something else. And I got a good luck. I sold the trading activities to a company called Enron, US-based company. Enron went to the bank robbery, but not because they spot our trading activity. So
the moment so you said Enron, I was thinking, I know the name.
And then with that money, we started to do local business with the decent working hours. So it was a big jump to the area where I was not specialist at all. But based on the trading know-how, we managed to supply the system very efficient way, and then we started to be successful there as well. And little by little, we growed all the time, and we bought assets of big oil companies when they decided to give up small markets like Finland, Sweden, and Norway. And we're growing from fossil to the states where we were actually 2006. And 2006 is in the big milestone, because that date, I just look at for this TV show, when we established our strategy vision to be CO2 aware energy producer and seller, it happened 2006.
We were so far ahead of everyone. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. We started the wind power project already 2004, but this energy, strategy vision has been there same since 2006, and it's going to be there as long as I'm going to stay alive, or as long as I'm allowed to run the board of the ST1. So if I'm losing my sense, maybe they then kick me out. But anyway, as long as I'm a charge, that is going to be our strategy vision, and we have done work since that very systematically to go into transformation. And one thing is very I'm talking all the time.
I know, we got here all talkers, you know, we can talk for hours. So it's just to explain to our audience why we have you as a chairman of a fossil fuel company, right? Because it's not really impactful in this way, but you know, you are one who is representing the transformation of companies of energy sector, and this is why we invited you, you know, to set up new standards in energy sector. So could you please explain to us and tell us more about your activities of your company in this sector, like renewable energies? How do you transform to more sustainable practices?
Yeah, it's very important to understand, first of all, that the energy sector is transformation business. And I guess we understood this very early stage after 2000 that this energy sector has to be transformed from fossil to renewable. Then, of course, we were a very small company at that time, and I didn't have a balance sheet like Shell or Exxon or anything like that. We were very small. So we had to pick up those areas where we really can do something in real life, make investments which are the size of our company. And but anyway, we have a clear idea that we have to start to walk this path. And in end of the path, we don't know where it leads to in final end, but it goes away from the fossil world. It goes to the renewable world. And we did all these things what company our size can do 2006. And we started with waste production, waste-based ethanol production. It was very small unit in Finland, and we used bakery waste, and we made out of that ethanol. And simultaneously, we started our windmill project in a city called Pori, and then little by little we have grown since that today's position, where our turnover, it was if I remember correct, I don't look at too much turnovers, but it was roughly six billion euros. Out of that, today 20% is already renewable. And somebody might say that 20%, it's not much, but if you start from the zero and you have done that with your own equity, with your own cash flow, and in 15 years' time, I'm at least quite happy about it. Of course, we could have done even more, but we haven't had any more resources.
What would be your aim, like the number where you are targeting, like this? Which
of course we, are targeting to the situation that we don't have any fossil left. But when that could be the case, I don't know. So it's not only our effort which accounts. It's really the regulatory environment. It's totally depending on also how our customers will behave. What kind of products, what kind of cars they are buying. There are many different type of issues which has impacted how quickly this will happen. But one thing is for sure, it will happen, and sooner or later. And I have always said that this target, what our political leaders and now even business leaders are doing, one way they are good to have, but if you are stuck with your targets, sometimes you start to do a little bit stupid things, and then you have to see that if the technology, for example, is not ready for the big size investments, you should do the small investments until it's basically ready for the big investments. I can give you a very good example. The wind energy in Finland 2010, when we had our first big park ready, the production cost was 58 euros per megawatt hour. 10 years later, only 10 years later, the production cost for our latest wind park was 28 euro per megawatt hour. So the drop of a production cost in 10 years time.
Solar panels are also dramatically decreased in terms of cost for production. So it happens when the industry is changing, when systems are changing, of course. Yeah.
And that is very important to remember that when we are doing the investment, we do it at the right time, then we are getting the best value for the money.
Yeah.
And if you start to do it too early, then you are spending a lot of money, but you are not getting that much result. And on the other hand, if you are too late, then we are too late. So timing is here very important matter, especially from company's point of view. Of course, when the national, our world leaders are talking, they can set the targets for the planet, but it's a different thing to set the target for the companies.
Company, exactly. Yeah, and I was going through very quickly through your annual report because you publish everything out there. You're completely transparent. So can you describe what kind of renewable energy you're investing in and whether your investment is in creating the infrastructure to sell the renewable energy or doing research on finding new kinds of renewable energy?
All of them, but I maybe pick up only a couple of them just to save your time. but the most important matters what we are doing, geothermal heat is definitely one. We have a plant in Espoo. You mentioned that Ben already. Yeah. It's only one in the planet where we have a 2 6 kilometers deep hole to the solid rock. And now it has been great, fantastic platform for us to develop the geothermal heat to the commercial scale. And now we already know that the commercial production plants are not going to be 6 kilometers deep holes. More likely, they are going to be 1.5 to 2 kilometers. But without doing this type of test, we couldn't have find the ways how is the best way to operate on those deep conditions.
Yeah.
And it has been very, very important to have this platform. But that's a good example. To do that, when we started, we didn't have a clue how it's going to be. Is it going to be successful at all? What is going to happen? And the total budget was roughly 35 million euros. It ends up today. Today's situation is that we have consumed 100 million euros and still it's not operating like we planned. It should be operating. We are getting it to that level, but it still cost a little bit more, but we have learned a lot. And this is a very good example that what does it mean when you are doing research and developing work in the energy sector. You have to be able to put a lot of money to start with, and then results cannot be guaranteed. And you have to have vision and you have to strongly believe on what you are doing. For us, the benefit is, of course, that we don't have to obligation to pay dividends while we are not stock listed. So that's helps. Then two others, which I just mentioned, three actually. We are developing biofuels, which based on sustainable raw materials like sawdust from the pulp and paper industry. Mm-hmm. They can't do anything with that. It's 40% water, and present biofuels are not going to be very big solution for the climate change battle because lack of sustainable raw materials. On biofuels, the key thing is that we have to develop the new technologies to be able to adapt sustainable raw materials, and that is the key. That's what we are doing. Then we are in wind business, that's I already said, we have sold our own mills to the pension funds. They are nowadays happy with 2 or 3% return. So we thought that it's better to be operator than keep it in our own balance sheet. We can do much more with that money in other areas. And then one thing what is very important in climate change fight, it's that we are involved in copper farming, so reforestation. And we have now a couple of projects what I cannot say anything about because they are together with stock listed companies and outside of Europe, but very promising project where we have a totally new measurement system together with us. So in the University of Helsinki, there is a scientist called Markku Kulmala, who is one of the most well-known scientist on the area, and he and his group has developed the measurement system that we can specifically measure how much trees will absorb coal to the earth. Not just to the tree, but because tree has to be cut and used in some states, but that which part with which goes to the roof, that is important, and then that is that can be measured. And while you can measure that, then you can make it a commercial product, and then the market can start to work. And that is very, very interesting. I think it's one of the areas where we might hear in 3-4 years very good news that we have a carbon sink market and a possibility to build a carbon sink market, because we need much greener planet as well. We have already 1,000 million tons extra CO2 in the atmosphere, and one way or another it has to be taken back to the earth.
Yeah, exactly.
So am I understanding right, just for our audience, you know, we were talking about EU life carbon farming scheme where you are also participating, right? So and you are in the deforestation
We would like to invest to the reforestation, but this is very important to say that together with the local population, the schemes has to be built in a way that they have a earning philosophy in this project and on their based on their own culture and based on their conditions. We have in Morocco one testing where we are checking that which trees are working best in different type of condition and what kind of irrigation system needs to be there and soil improvement and so on. And when we talk first time with Morocco people, they're asking that we told everything and you are getting all the benefits. And then they ask that, oh, no, Mr. Antonen, what benefits you are getting? You are putting money here and what you are getting? Oh, we are getting CO2 in atmosphere down. And they look at each other. This guy must be totally crazy. But then we explain that there will be, or it's condition for the whole thing, that there has to be a carbon market where this secretion of the carbon back to the soil, there is a value for it.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Otherwise, this does not, of course, happen. But if that there is a value for that, then you can keep clean water, what you are getting as a side product. You can keep all the trees and cut them once in 2 years' time, because then you can cut them and put the new one instead. And because we want to get this carbon back to the earth, right. And that is what we would like to do. So it's we cut the tree and put the new tree again, and that is the idea, and that is something what I'm very, very keen on to see to happening, because this emission cuts, we do see that there is a path how to do that one, but we also have to get simultaneously extra carbon from the atmosphere back to the
earth. Exactly, and I think there you Finns have really, really a lot of knowledge and expertise in the forest engineering.
Yeah. That's correct. That's I guess we have a very good knowledge on that, and I have said all the time to our forest industry that you should put more effort into this one and help the world to do this.
Yeah,
but just what I had in mind, you know, to share it, you know, because some people just even don't know that such a possibility exists,
yeah.
And especially fossil fuel companies. Like, how could you set up new standards for transition, you know, for more companies to doing what you guys are doing as well?
You know, I think Finns are not very good at selling.
Yeah, we are very bad on that. So yeah, let me put it this way. But luckily, I don't want to advertise any company here. But I think company called Shell, everybody knows, and they have been now a little bit in the court as well. I have heard what comes to the emission. They have seriously put a lot of effort and money to this kind of reforestation programs, but they are not recognized out of it too much. I don't know why. Have they marketing it or not? I don't know. Maybe people think that if Shell is doing something like that, it's greenwash or something. But I think they are very serious, and they really I can see that inside, that they really would like to be successful in this field as well. They called it natural based solutions, and the idea what they do have is pretty much similar than ours, that we realize that the fossil fuels, we don't get rid of them in one day. There are still, even whatever we do, the oil is going to be there for a certain number of years. I don't know how many, but anyway, it's going to stay there. So we could, I have asked from our politicians that please regulate us, that in case I'm selling a 1 liter of gasoline, I have to put this many trees to somewhere. And somebody then, Markku Kulmala and his scientists, they will measure that what I have done is according to the rules.
Yeah.
So that is basically a very simple thing. And but
that's so cool. Please regulate us. But I think if you need to beg for politicians to regulate you, there is something wrong. So how can
And what I also worry about is that there's so much knowledge about how to manage the forestry with Finland, but it's, if you look at EU, I can only speak from EU, a lot of policies or decisions are being made because they don't have that knowledge. So the decisions also are not really very correct. But that's another discussion.
Discussion. Yeah.
Exactly. And that will take a whole evening and a lot of bottles of wine.
Should I bring some? Do it a bit longer today.
No, but I also wanted, so you are an energy company, but most of the energy companies, like we know Shell and ExxonMobil, they have sustainability as a part of their CSR, their corporate social responsibility. But you have it as a core of your company policy. So how did, were you always from the starting like this, or did you evolve or transform into this?
No, I didn't have it in there as a starting point. I was very normal young student when I joined Neste Trading, and I then learned to do my job. But in some point when I had that opportunity to see that how this world really works, and then when I got a children of my own, and I can't say the exact day when I got an idea that we have to do things differently. So this cannot go anymore like this, that we just do the normal stuff and sell oil and wait that how long it will last, and it cannot go like that. I can't tell you the date when it happened. It was a maybe 2 years, 3 years thinking process, and then one day we had our company management seminar, and we decided that we have to go into that direction, that we will live in line with this planet, with the Mother Earth, and how can we do that? Because we are selling gasoline and diesel. Come on. Then we have to build up something out of that starting point. And that is actually, in my opinion, quite encouraging for companies like Shell. And I think they have noticed that now. I'm talking about Shell now because with them I have done a lot of work together. When I told them 2010 when I bought Shell Sweden and Finland, I told them about our renewable visions and CO2 aware energy and so on. And they were a couple of guys in London. They said that interesting, but the tone has totally changed. Tone has totally changed. They have changed. They are not anymore same company. So I trust very much that the people, maybe public, they don't know or they don't recognize it or maybe they don't believe on it. But Shell made a couple of years ago promise that they released press release, I guess it was press release where they were saying that they are going to be to 2030 world biggest renewable electricity producer. That's a hell of a promise. If they will keep that promise, I can guarantee you that none of the other promises in this planet are not even close to that promise. So that's a fantastic promise if they keep it. And when we look at the other energy companies, there are many others who has taken this very, very seriously. They are on the right path. But there are, of course, companies who hasn't done anything. And I don't want to start to point it out who are the bad guys and who are the good bad guys. I guess audience can read the newspaper by themselves. Yeah, exactly. I can talk about the positive things.
Yeah, exactly. No, you must have heard what Mark Carney said, I think last week or 2 weeks ago. When he spoke, you know, Mark Carney, the former governor, he mentioned that all the companies who are aligned with the Paris Agreement or who are thinking about CO2, they will not only have more value for their shareholders, they will also have better business, more profit, and better for the community. And companies who are not doing it, they are going to end up with massive amount of stranded assets.
I think in big picture, he is very right. I fully agree. Mm-hmm. But again, devil is in details. While you are saying that, you have to remember that transformation has to be done inside the company. Yeah. When you are releasing and closing down your fossil assets and building up the new ones, you have to look at that how the environment will develop. If you don't have any. Like electricity cars are something what is very different states in different countries. We are operating in Norway, Sweden, and Finland. Norway, there are huge amount. I think its density of electricity cars is the highest on the planet.
It's number one. It's number
yes,
one.
Yes, number world. One. Yeah. It's totally different to operate there compared to operate in Finland or Sweden. And then you have to take into account the business environment and how the people are behaving and what kind of rules and regulations are coming by politicians. That is company cannot just decide that, okay, we just now got rid of all fossil and we do something else if there is no demand. So so that is companies definitely should look at the future, like Mark said, but keeping in mind that while you are saying something or justifying companies, are they doing right or wrong, you have to look at also the business environment and regulatory environment, what really they can do and what they cannot do.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I think you have one very big advantage. You don't have shareholders jumping up and down your neck.
That is especially nobody is complaining about too low dividends. So, because we have a very, very simple policy. I want to keep the company alive because it's also sustainable that your business is going to be successful. That's very important. There are 1,000 people working for our company, and I can't let them down. I can't do stupid things in a way that they are losing their jobs. But what I can control is that the part with what normal companies, stock-listed companies, would pay as a dividends, that money we can, the money what our employees has done from the market, that money we can use to develop renewable energy solutions. Yeah. And that's what we have done.
Exactly.
I understand. Mika, but you are also investor as person and also, of course, as ST1. Can you share with us and with our audience what kind of investment selection criteria are you applying as person and as ST1, if it's any different? Because you have a lot of amazing projects who are looking for money, of course. So maybe there is someone who will be
renewable energy and things like that.
Exactly.
It's very good question and simple to answer as well. ST1 is only investing to the business project, so they don't put money to the project where which is not done based on business logic. But then Mr. Antonen can do other things because he is individual, and I have done many things, but I don't want to advertise them because I'm having already today too many emails where people are asking support for a very good project. But of course, every one of us has limited resources. Limit is coming to everyone, and I try to support as much as I can. But of course, I'm not that type of guy what you were talking at the beginning of the show. I'm not Elon Musk or any of those guys. I'm a small guy from Finland. So am I?
You are paying your taxes, so in conscious development.
I pay the taxes. That's one reason why I don't have so much money to spend to the other purposes, because I pay the taxes.
Exactly. So now we leave behind ST1 and now we come to Mika. Yeah. So,
but let me please add one more thing. So for all those who cannot approach Mr. Antonen as an investor, please come to camomile.ch, register there, and we will invite Mr. Antonen anyway as a member. So maybe one day or another day you will be lucky and he will
find the right
project.
You will
get his attention. Exactly.
So I wanted to ask about is that because I have also been involved in the sector of alternative energy since quite a long time. And every time we begin with a positive intention. So I remember in Netherlands, we were extremely enthusiastic about bioenergy, soya. We use soybean for biodiesel. And we invested in it. We advertised it. We spoke about it everywhere. But now it turns out that this soya production is damaging the rainforest in Indonesia, in the Amazon, everywhere. So we have this in the name of green investment and green policies. We are making decisions which are very good, which looks very attractive, but on long term, it is doing damages we did not think it will do. So I know that you have also thought on this topic very, very much. Can you also give some more examples, like where we thought that this was a very good idea, we acted on it, and then we turned out it was not so green and not so good for the environment after all?
Yeah, my experience, really the own experience, is coming from the biofuels mainly. And that's when we started in 2006 with the waste-based ethanol production, I was a great believer that the biofuels could play very big role in our transition from fossil to renewable. But then when we got more information and we discussed more with different type of stakeholders, we started to realize that, oops, these raw materials, they are quite limited what comes to the sustainability. We turned our direction to go into the direction where we can maybe find more sustainable raw materials. But right now, our ambition, this is a very good example, this biofuel, that when ambition level is set by information what we had 10, 15 years ago, and now we are executing that, and new information has come up. And it's when we set the biofuel target for EU, for example, we had an idea that we can easily produce that much biofuels what EU will request based on this mandate. But now when we have started to realize that what kind of raw materials we have to really use, the knowledge has grown and we have started to see that really we can't use that much, we can't produce that much biofuels, because if we produce, there are very negative impacts some other areas. Like food production is a very simple example, but there are similar example, for example, animal fat. Everybody thinks that it's fantastic raw material for biodiesel, but not too many people realize that a good part of the animal fat will be used for pet food. And then the question is that if pet food is not getting the material from the animal fat market, they have to get it from somewhere else, because your dogs and cats, they still eat. And then the benefit is not anymore that great. Or if we look at the used cooking oil, which everybody thinks that it's a fantastic idea that we will take from restaurants the used cooking oil and we use that. What has happened? This is a little bit a joke, but not totally, that we start to have more used cooking oil what we have cooking oil. So if you understand what I mean, that because value in the diesel production is so high that if you put one French fries to the cooking oil and then you said it's used cooking oil, then it's okay for the diesel production, and that will lead again to the end result where we use the land or food production basically to be able to make biofuels, and that is not sustainable. Raw materials has to come from elsewhere, and then these logistical examples that come on, we have checked all our supply chains where the product is coming, we respect their human rights and things like that, normal procedures, and on those checking it's quite interesting cases while we look at the used cooking oil from China, for example. It will start from the restaurants with 10 liters cannons, and then it goes to the next station, and the cooking oil moves through the country and ends up to the port where the seagoing vessel will take the whole cargo into Europe, and then one of the diesel producer here then make diesel out of that used Chinese cooking oil. If you calculate CO2 correctly, you can easily understand that it doesn't really save the world at all. And if it's good thing, and it is good thing to use that used cooking oil, definitely it should be used in China. Why the hell we are taking that up to the Europe and produce its city diesel? Answer is very simple. Because in Nordics, for example, we have a highest bio mandate, so we are paying highest price. So that's why we collect all these raw materials from China, we ship it into the Europe, we make out of the city diesel and we biodiesel, and we tell the audience that now we have done good climate act. And what we should have done, we should have agreed with Chinese that they will produce out of that used cooking oil biodiesel, and they will use it, for example, in Beijing or Shanghai, where the air quality is not the best possible. So those kind of things, we have plenty of them. So this
logical business,
exactly. And every what is common to every one of these things, and this is very important, we should have a checking in every act what we are doing, that what are the global consequences if we do this. If we only do the EU policy and we stop the analysis to the EU borders, then that's wrong. That's horribly wrong. Yeah. Our politicians, they have been telling us quite long in EU that EU is so good example. We have had economic growth since 90 up to 2020. Fantastic. and then simultaneously we have cut down our CO2 emissions. Of course, we have cut down our CO2 emissions because we decided to move all manufacturing industry to Asia, to China and elsewhere, and they are producing our products today, and we are just getting them by vessels or by airmail, and emissions will stay outside of the EU region. So that is something that you have to look at always, the climate acts in a global content, even if the regulation is area based or country based. You have to analyze it against the whole world, because atmosphere does not respect the borders. So that's something what you have to remember.
Yeah. And Mika, we also have another question for you. You know, last week we had one guest with whom we discussed actually the thing that fossil fuels alone cannot be blamed for destruction of our environment, because the society, as long as it remains addicted to petrol, is also responsible for that. So what would you think about it, and what would be the right remedy to change that?
Yeah. It's clear, but not everybody realizes it, that our standard of living based on usage of fossil fuels. If you look at where we were 150 years ago and look at where we are today, without cheap and transferable energy, what we have got from the fossil fuels, we wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't have computers, we wouldn't have any of that stuff. So our standard of living based on fossil fuels and usage of fossil fuels. So then if we start to blame somebody that it's your fault that the CO2 content is so high, I guess that does not lead to anywhere. So we are all guilty, and we are not guilty. I wouldn't try to find the guilty ones. It's not the fruitful. It doesn't take us anywhere from the point where we are. We should look at the future, that how we are getting these big oil companies and who has benefit out of the fossil fuel most, how we are getting those stakeholders to take responsibility and start to find new solutions. Anyway, they have a huge balance sheets. If we are getting all the oil companies and coal companies to the transformation like ST1 is today, then we can really make it work. Yeah. So startups cannot solve this problem. I have many times described the energy system and transformation of the energy system. It's like a moving train. It's the train has to move all the time, because you need electricity every day. You need energy every day. So train has to move all the time. But same time when train is moving, you have to change every part of the train. And that is a tricky exercise. And the present train owners, they definitely are in best position to do the job.
The restaurant department of the train enjoying the life. No, they don't care about
exactly.
Change.
We all are passengers on that train, and we would like to have a nice and smooth lift. So that is something what we have to remember. I think it's not lead anywhere to find guilty ones. We are in good track right now, and we should keep the pressure on, especially on those companies who still doesn't recognize that they have to make the change, but not pointing out the companies that you are the guilty ones, because of you we are in this situation. That's not the honest way to look at it anyway. So we are all guilty in that respect.
And talking about that, I now want to come to the EU. So when I was still in the Netherlands, so I remember the livestock was often moved out of Netherlands to Poland, processed there, brought back. There was a lot of money made with extra subsidies, tax benefits, because of the EU policies. The EU policies were still not that very well regulated on the borders. but it was very bad for the environment, and it was also very bad for the animal well-being. And you also mentioned similar happenings of movement of peat stock within Europe in your annual report. Can you explain what it is, and what are the pluses and the minuses of that?
Yeah, I think I already answered partly to that question. This Chinese used cooking oil was one good example out of it. So it's a pretty much same type of category that we are. Or that was in my mind when we talked about it, that this Chinese used cooking oil. There are maybe smaller examples, but that one I guess audience already got it, so I don't want to tell the same story. Okay. But that is basically good example out of it, that we are importing raw materials, and these raw materials cannot be then the developing countries, or not even developing countries. China is not anymore developing countries, but we are taking raw materials from elsewhere to our country, because our regulator has put that type of rules in place that we can pay much higher price for the raw material. Yeah. And then raw material ends up here, and then the country where we have taken the raw material away from cannot meet their own targets. Yeah. And mm-hmm. and then there will be a lot of unoptimized systems, and that was exactly point what I said earlier on. When we are making rules and we are making policies, we should always have a global look at the before we put it valid, because then we can check that what kind of consequences will happen in outside of our region, in case we execute the rules like we have wrote them.
Yeah, and absolutely. And you know, also, I want to ask the following question, because it's very much connected to that. As our population grows, so we will require more energy, and most of it is producing CO2 emissions. So how can we break this vicious circle, in your opinion?
That's a tricky thing. I have a talk with very high level politicians, or not very high, but high level politicians and business leaders, and they all of them are saying that yes, we can break this disconnection between economic growth and emission growth. Europe is a good example out of it. Then I said, let's be honest about it. If we look at the Europe, what has happened in that 30 years period, what you are talking about? How much factories we have moved from Europe to China and to third countries? And that is the reason why our emissions has gone down. The products mm-hmm. what we are using is not anymore produced in Europe. And they are produced, China, globalization is the word what we are talking about here. Globalization. What comes to Europe, it means that we have moved most of our manufacturing work to elsewhere, and then emissions can be measured there, but we don't take those into account. So I really hope that we will find the technologies, and we will find systems in a way that we can have a simultaneously economic growth and cut off emissions, but I can't say that it's possible before I see that it's really can happen. So far it has not happened. If we look at this growth, what we are going to see after pandemic, we have already some indications from IEA, International Energy Agency. We are going to have a record high growth on emissions, CO2 emissions, because we have record high economic growth. Yeah. And that is still, that connection exists, and we have to work very hard to break that connection. And I wouldn't give that kind of promise that it's easy or it can be just execute them, because we don't really have yet solutions for that. The population growth, what you mentioned, it's a huge element on this this game as well, and especially if you take into account that simultaneously when the population will grow, also standard of living will grow, and of course it should grow, because we have, according to UN, we have almost 5 billion people on this planet who are living less than 8 euros per day. They don't even know what CO2 is. And really, it's not their fault. So they want to have a better life, and that will generate, with their infrastructure, it will generate more emissions. That's the fact. So IEA's leader, I can't remember his name, but sorry about it. But he said a couple of weeks ago, when the IEA released their latest report, what was the so-called emergency path to meet 1.5 degree target. Yeah. In final speech of his, he said that we have to understand, especially among the developing countries, that people, countries on this planet will start this climate change acts from very different starting points. And if we rich countries, if we don't have solidarity towards poor countries, this is mission impossible. And I guess he didn't say exactly these words, because in his position, he can't say that it's mission impossible. I can say that, but it's really, it is mission impossible if we don't support the poor countries in their battle against climate change, because they just don't have resources to pay any extra. If you think about energy systems, and that's something what I think is a very good example. You have a countries in Africa like Mozambique, you have a country like Vietnam in Asia, the list is long, which don't have electricity in some areas at all. They start from the zero. And when you start from the zero, somebody might think that, oh, it's fantastic, then you can do wind energy or solar industry energy, but you can only do if you have existing infrastructure, where you have a grid connections, where you have a hydropower, a nuclear power, or something else for those moments when sun is not shining and wind is not blowing. So if you start from the zero, you ask that, okay, I need the lights during the night or evening. So if sun is not shining, what am I going to do with that kind of system? Quite fair question. And then we are coming to the technology solutions like power to X. This is maybe the audience not that well known, but it's basically the technology which based on the hydrogen, we will use renewable electricity to produce hydrogen from the water. And then we'll catch the CO2 either from the emission source directly from the factory, or we take it from the atmosphere and we put hydrogen and CO2 together, and we are getting hydrocarbons. And hydrocarbons are all fossil fuels, what we do have today in our system. And those kind of products we can store and we can handle them. We call them synthetic fuels. And that is the future what we really, or that is the missing technology. It's not the technology is not missing, but all these things will work as an individual thing. But putting everything together, we have some demonstrations around the world, but we don't have yet industrial scale factories like that. And they are going to be, at the beginning, very expensive. But those kind of things we definitely need to be able to build up the energy system where we don't need fossil at all.
Yeah. But Mika, isn't it that also our life standards, you know, you mentioned better life. What is better life, right? So it's because better life is for some people having several cars, several homes, flying around. So it's all based on energy consumption. So we need to change this better life perception what is better life? Maybe being more with a family, having one house, but living in more in the nature, you know? So this, I think, also must somehow change before we
this,
can...
You are absolutely right. You're absolutely right. So because it's quite clear that these 5 billion people who are living less than 8 euro per day, they have all rights to improve their standard of living. And if they will do that, it will request more energy, it will request more natural resources. So then us, if we look at our people who are living in Western countries, I cannot talk too much about this because I'm in privileged position by myself. But we should be happy with the present standard of living. I guess it's not really something too much to ask, really, if we say that. Why don't we just be happy with the present standard of living? Mm-hmm. Maybe mm-hmm. even a little bit less. Some people could have much more less, but yeah. but that is thinking. Yeah, but that is thinking what we should talk about more, because if we look at the total system's point of view, it's necessary that we will create the system where 60% of the population can still improve their standard of living. And it's very difficult to make that work in case we all in Western world still would like to have another car, another house, and another round trip around the world, and a couple of sailing boats on top of that, and all that stuff. So, the life can be even much more happy. I fully agree. So it's totally depending on your own mindset. But I'm very optimistic on this matter. I think next generation, our children, they already think differently.
Yeah,
they already think differently, and we have to give us time. The human is that type of animal, that Homo sapiens, that we would like to see everything happened during our lifetime. And if we look at the history and we look at the future, from the history we can learn a lot of things. Many things, big changes, good changes, has taken some time. And I think we have enough knowledge and intelligence in this world that our children and their children, they find a way to live better in balance with Mother Nature than what we have done. And that respect, I'm optimistic. About it. But of course, we could do our share and speed up the process to get rid of unsustainable lifestyle and move to the renewable world. But I have to say that I'm not a perfect role model by myself either. I travel, I eat meat. My daughter, oldest daughter, will complain about that every day. Not every day, but every now and then. And I'm not a role model, and I don't want to be a role model. I'm just doing the things what I can do, and then. I guess everybody should give her or himself mercy in that respect, that life cannot be miserable. You have your own life, and it's your own life, and it's only life what you have. So it's important that you will find happy feelings out of it. And taking, for example, this climate change so seriously that you are having nightmares and psychological problems because of that. It's not worth it. It's not worth it.
Yeah.
We are going to solve it. It will take some time, but we are going to solve it. So it's
also being so optimistic, you know, not all the guests are so optimistic. Well, I'm happy we have optimistic ones.
I don't see that pessimist can ever let him or herself down because she or he is thinking already that everything goes wrong anyway. But optimistic people, they can make the change to happen because mm-hmm. you have to have hope. Without hope, you don't have action. And yeah. and even if the hope is small percentage, we still have hope. And I'm a great believer that we can make this change happen. I'm not worried about the technology at all. I think what comes to technology, we will find a solution. I'm worried about solidarity between the people. Yeah. That's what I'm worried about. That is the mm-hmm. that is the. Do we have enough wisdom to make investments, for example, to the developing countries where we are not getting any other benefit than Mother Earth will feel better? So is that good reason enough to make investment? In my opinion, it is. But we need regulatory rules to make it happen in a market economy.
Exactly. But there I come to the question about the government system, because the changes you mentioned, like in the history or past, lot of problems were solved by, but now we have democratic system. And there I, in my opinion, one of the weaknesses, if you look at Japan, it's one of the most advanced and industrialized nation. Per person energy consumption is very high, like every other industrialized nation. And they were quite very well on their way to cut down their CO2 emission and turning their energy production to green. And then the earthquake and the tsunami at Fukushima happened. And then the whole public opinion turned against the nuclear energy. And now you see Japan is building again more and more coal power stations, and they're planning to build even more. Same is happening in countries like Germany, where the public opinion changes from one day to another because of a reason. And then the government acts accordingly. So what would you think about this?
That is, I have thought about a lot. It's a very, very big challenge for the democracy. I'm a great believer of democracy. Don't read me wrong. We have all seen that what kind of things can happen if you don't have democracy. So democracy has own weaknesses, but it's still best system by far. But democracy can deliver. Democracy can deliver also these kind of results. And I think answer to those kind of problematic situations is that we still have to deliver right type of information to the people as much as even if the things go wrong, then we just can't keep up. We just have to come again with the new information and say that, come on, let's rethink this. Is this really the reason to do this type of thing? And I use this, your example was a very good one. And now what is going to happen in Germany, they are closing nuclear power plants, which could work very well next 10, 20 years, whatever. But that would help a lot in EU's transformation period if those nuclear power plant would continue.
Yeah.
And the reason why they have decided to close it down, like you said, it was Fukushima probably was the last trigger. They had already before that the doubts, but that was the last trigger. And what is now happening after that? These nuclear power plants, which are there, which could work still many decades forward, they are closing them down. And not more than 100 kilometers from German border, Poland is going to build the new ones. Mm-hmm. And how is that possible then? And then we are coming to the point that even inside EU, we don't have common rules. We don't make the analysis outside of the borders. We just look at our own country, and maybe we look at EU, but definitely we don't look at what's going to happen because of our decision outside of EU. And here, German citizens they will find out sooner or later that, okay, we have decided now to close our nuclear power plant, but these Polish guys, they will build up the new ones next to our borders. And is it better that the nuclear power plants is on the other side of the border or in our side of the border? I guess democracy has to think about that in some point. Yeah. I think it's still not too late to make another decision and say that, why don't we postpone this closing of these nuclear power plants in Germany?
Mika, and what do you think about the last legal case in Netherlands against Shell, where the judge held them responsible for the damages which will be caused by for climate change in the future?
Well, I think I said a little bit about that matter already at the beginning, that it's a quite tricky if you pick up one company and start to make rules against that. And here, especially when they picked up the Shell, which is in my mind from the oil companies the most advanced. They, like I said, that they have given a promise that they will be the biggest renewable electricity producer 2030 decade. And there are some other oil companies who are not committed to do anything. I don't name them, but like I said,
before legal case started or afterwards?
They had promised, but now they mentioned that they will speed it up.
Okay.
Yeah, now they speed it up, and in one way, these kind of legal cases, they can't be useful, that they will send a strong signal. Mm-hmm. What is the expectation of the population and expectations of democracy? Yeah. But it's very dangerous in case you will really go to the after one company only. I think the court should have gone after all companies who are in the same industry, and not picking up the one company. And especially this time, it went totally wrong because they pick up the wrong company. But as a policy, I don't like this type of idea
like
that we.
Maybe also.
Yeah, I think. I know that they are trying to do ultimate best on this field, and in that respect, if you speed up their emission, taking emission down too quickly, what will happen then? Their cash flow from the business, what somebody is doing anyway, will go down, and their capability to make these new investments will suffer quite substantially. That's a if I look at my business, some people have said to me during our voyage that, Mika, you have a CO2-aware energy producer and seller vision. Why don't you stop selling gasoline and diesel today? You can do that. I said, well, I can do that, but then I don't have a healthy cash flow, and where I'm going to get all the money to execute this renewable energy R&D project and investments, where the money is coming from. And that is important to understand that it's these big oil companies and big fossil energy companies, they have a huge balance sheet, and regulators should make sure that the balance sheet is used to make this transformation possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one more topic which has been very interesting in this sector, because you know, I'm also with the Rockefeller brothers. And they started initiating this disinvestment. So there's a kind of activism investors. You don't have problems with that, but companies which have a lot of shareholders have problems with that. For example, you must have heard that in ExxonMobil last month, I think 2 weeks ago, last week, they fired two of the directors. They were ousted by the shareholders. So there's this kind of disinvestment movement also going around in the world where the shareholders are withdrawing money from fossil fuel companies. Even here in Zug, companies like Glencore and everybody is having problem because they're losing shareholders who are disinvesting. What do you think about that?
Well, investors, they have all right to do so. So I guess they are having probably different reasons. Some of them are there for ideal reasons. Some of them are there for monetary reasons, whatever reasons are, but they have total right to do whatever they wish because they are shareholders. That's their role, that they can force the company to do according to their will. But again, here I would like to demonstrate that if you are collecting so-called points by being publicly allowed and forcing somebody to do something, for example, board members in Exxon, that is a good example. There were, by the way, Finnish lady was selected to the Exxon board, and it was a big news here in Finland. She has done career earlier in Neste Oil on biodiesel side. And you can do such a kind of actions, but in final end, this board, they still have to make decisions in a way that the company is profitable. That's according to law as well, that the stock listed company directors has to make such a decisions that the company is profitable. And idealist type of approach is one approach, but still you have to have a common sense and business sense on those proposals that the company can really deliver after those decisions positive cash flow. That's necessary to make the transformation to happen.
Fiduciary duty, of course, of the board to deliver also to investors. It's absolutely correct.
Yeah.
Mika, we are running out of time. Very quickly, okay. One challenging question. It's challenging, but let me ask it, and please be short in your answer. So it's about Norway being a very good example, like moving into green energy, you know, and cutting down CO2 emissions. But still, Norway is supplying other countries with fossil fuels in the world. And this is like exporting CO2 emissions to other countries, right? Like China is doing, supplying Africa and Asia with their coal power stations. So what would you say to that?
Well, they are a little bit different stories, both Norway and China. I'm very sure. I think even if Norway will stop the oil and the gas production, still Saudi Arabia and Russian will supply double times that. So it doesn't really solve anything. I rather see that this money goes to Norway, which will deliver back quite a lot because they are. Like I said, that they are highest in the electricity car density, and they are using huge amount of government subsidies to make this transformation to happen. So if somebody has to benefit out of the fossil fuels, I rather see that it's Norway than any other country. Yeah.
No, okay.
Maybe that's the answer to that one.
Yeah.
And very last comment from your side, or like call to action to the viewers, maybe the fossil fuel industry, what would you say to them? So and, what would be
and also the common action. Man, the common people on the street, what can they do to help the environment in your point of view?
I think when you have a money and opportunity to buy a new car, then of course you should buy the one where the emissions are the lowest possible. There are different technologies available, but of course you have to look at what is fit for purpose in each and every case. And then what you can do, you can look at your own lifestyle. That's nothing to do with the car or our pieces itself, but you can look at your own lifestyle, what we already touched a little bit earlier, that what are you eating, what are your own habits, what are you doing, eats and everything. They not necessarily are that much what comes to the impact, but it keeps the subject all the time on the table, and then the pressure will be there then as well, that we don't forget the climate change in 2 years' time and start to do something else. So that hype, what we have today, it's very important that every customer will do their own share, that hype does not be as a hype, but it will continue like a process, and we will go into the direction of renewable energy system and sustainable world.
Thank you very, very much. I think after this interview, because Mika had invited us to his place in Finland, but after this interview, he is not going to invite us.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Why not? You didn't ask it. I have joined your interview. It has been very, very interesting, and hopefully the audience as well. That's always difficult to say if they have enjoyed at all. But at least I have had a good time, and thank you very much. It was a great opportunity to discuss about these important matters, and hopefully this is also taking us one small step closer to the. To the direction that we have an impact like we wish, and renewable world and sustainable world is one step closer.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mika.
Thank you very much
for joining us.
And very nice summer, and hopefully you all are getting vaccinated soon and we can meet physically as well.
That would be fantastic.
Okay.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
This was amazing. I mean, he's such an amazing guy, and I know him quite long, so he's perfect. So
you forget to tell him that he will become our honorary member of Camomile.
No, I think you told him. You said that.
That's true. Okay, that's a good part.
So before we finish, just about next week. So next week we will be. I think this will be Svetlana Day because inward it is going to be a deep discussion on investment and finance in impact sector. We have two guests.
Scary our audience. Please don't disclose.
And this will be really detailed in finance. And our guests will again be from our friends from Finland. But one of them is living in Dubai. So it is Petri Kuusisto. He's a CIO of two of the largest Finnish pension funds and one of the Middle Eastern sovereign family fund. And he has written many articles on impact investment and has coined the term called sustainable portfolio theory. It's an extension to the modern portfolio theory and current strategic asset allocation thinking. So basically going towards blended finance, but not yet. I think the audience can understand.
You say too much already.
So it's more like a banking and investment sector. And Villa is a professional futurist and also an impact strategist. He lives, of course, in Dubai, like I mentioned, and he's a founding partner of Impact Innovation Institute and a senior faculty member at Dubai Future Academy. And he has been participating in a lot of World Economic Forum projects around the world.
So it will be very good discussion. So join us next week, same time, and keep watching Camomile for any updates. And act with impact. Thank you for joining us and watching us today. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee. I'm Svetlana.
And I'm Ben.
In season 2, we will be traveling around the globe, out of Switzerland, and bring amazing leaders from businesses, thought leaders, political leaders, of course, investors and experts.
We're working at implementing and realizing all the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, better known as SDGs.
And they are also making profit.
Hello, I am Amina Gurifakim, and I'm the sixth president of the Republic of Mauritius.
My name is Parvati, and I'm a musical artist and the founder and CEO of Parvati Foundation.
I'm Amisha Adish Musai. I'm an entrepreneur here in Bishkek. I'm running on one side of a financial services company.
You know, hundreds of deals a month, we are seeing more things happening in this impact world. And this is because, look, the world is changing.
So join us to discover impact investing ecosystem.
See you every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. Central European time at Swiss Impact with Benedict.
See you on Friday. Act with impact.